Right, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to make a start so that we've got plenty of time, hopefully left at the end for your questions. We're just getting a few more seats in for those of you who haven't quite got a physical chair just yet. We'll hopefully get you one very soon. Thank you so much for coming this afternoon. It's really great to see you. Lots of familiar faces, lots of faces I don't recognise as well. So for those of you who don't know me, my name's Becky Thomas. I started my working life in the NHS, then spent 15 years working as church operations manager at Beeston Free Church in southwest Nottingham, and I now work for FIEC. My title, all these titles don't really tell you anything, do they? But my title is Director for Church Governance. So my role is to provide support for churches in the area of governance, operations, all those practical areas of making church life tick. Also with me today is Gavin Smith. Gavin's got over 20 years of experience in church ops, serves at Christ Church in Newport, and also runs an organisation called The Church Office, which seeks to serve by supporting those behind the scenes in church life. We'll hear a bit more about the Church Office a little bit later on. But just to get us going, to get you engaged as well as just listening to us talking, I wonder why you've come along to this session today. I wonder what you're hoping to get out of it. I guess for some of you, the whys and hows of church governance are pretty new to you, and you're wanting to kind of get your head around, well, what's all this about? What's it all mean for us as a church? For others of you, you'll have been involved for a very long time, probably even longer than me, many of you. But perhaps you feel like you're constantly chasing your tail. You never quite feel like you know what you're doing. You never quite feel like you're on top of things. For some of you, governance and church operations will be part of a paid role. For many of you, it'll be part of a voluntary role. I suspect that either way, you perhaps didn't quite think that this was what you were signing up for when you got involved. Perhaps you didn't even quite know that you'd signed up when you first got involved. But I wonder whether you'd just take a minute, turn to the person next to you and just share very briefly, why are you here in this session? What are you hoping to get out of it? I'm just going to give you 2 minutes, so go quick. Okay, I'm going to cut across your conversation there. I wonder if just a few of you would just shout out why what you've just shared. Why are you here with us? Okay, knowing very little?
Check whether we're doing it right.
Check whether we're doing it right, yeah.
It's a nightmare that you might have overlooked something desperately serious.
Yeah, that fear of having overlooked something that you should have done, that you just didn't know about. One of the things I've said to a number of people when I was in my church ops role, probably the first thing I learned is that you don't know what you don't know. Anything else? Okay, so you see things in a template and you think, oh, was I supposed to have done that? Great. Okay, well, whatever you came along this afternoon, it's really our hope and our prayer that you go away at the end of this session having been reminded why good governance matters. Having a better grasp of the essentials and feeling a little bit more equipped to deal with some tools and some resources to help you deal with the things you come up against. I'm going to hand over to Gavin. Gavin, I wonder if you pray for us before we start, and then Gavin's going to help us start to think about why good governance matters.
All right, should we pray together? Father, thank you for this room that is full. Lord, thank you for your grace that's at work. And Father, we ask for grace. And we're aware that we can't get all of this right. And yet our hearts are to serve our churches and to ultimately serve the gospel. So would you speak to us? Would you press on our hearts where we might need to give some dedicated time to? Would you help us and increase our knowledge and the questions that we come with, Lord? Would those be answered through our preparation together by your grace? In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen. I don't know, I love the title. When Adrian talked to me about governance overload, I don't know what you first focus on, but I was immediately hit by the overload bit of it. You know, I love governance, and you know, everyone in this room must love governance, you know, because you're all here. But the overload feeling, I just couldn't escape. And when I often talk to leaders about good governance, we have to talk about capacity. And I think that's an important part to kind of slide into not only what we do, but actually, I know for many elders and many pastors, you know, we live in a kind of 7-day cycle from one Sunday to the next Sunday, running into danger and dealing with crisis all week. And then suddenly you've got to carve out some time to do everything that we're going to say. And I hope today you don't leave like guilty of all the things that you haven't done. But you might be inspired to do this work for the glory of God and for the gospel to go forward. So I wanted to try and come up with an illustration that kind of combines capacity with governance, right? So you're going to have to come along with me a little bit. And my wife said, don't overcook this illustration. But I said, I've got pastors in the room. They love a good illustration, so this is going to be fine. So if you think about a motorway, okay? And every motorway has a capacity, doesn't it? The capacity of number of cars that use it, and there are different aspects on that motorway that enable free-flowing traffic to go down it, okay? And it's the same with your church. Your church has a capacity, doesn't it, of your leader's capacity, your trustee board, your deacons, the members, the kind of gifting that you have in your church, the resources that you have, all of those things. You have a certain capacity. So you might have one lane, or you might be a big church having five lanes of motorway. What's important is how do we combine these two together? And I was thinking, I came from Wales, Newport, and I spent about an hour and a half on the M6 coming here. And I was thinking about this illustration, and then it was like God said, actually, I'm going to put you right in the middle of it. So you can observe all the things that you talked about in real detail. And the first thing that strikes you about a motorway is the central reservation. Okay, it's boring. It's almost unimpressive. You almost don't notice it. But it's one of the most significant safety features on a motorway, isn't it? It helps us to set direction. It helps us not to stray across into oncoming danger. And that might be our governing document. That might be some of our principles of good governance. That central reservation is the thing that's going to keep us safe. And often with governance, you don't know how good your governance is until something goes wrong, you know. And that's the feeling of overload as well, isn't it? The mental overload of have we done enough here? So the central reservation. Other things that are important on the motorway, the line markings, okay? So you're going to go with me on this illustration, okay, on this journey with me, okay? The line markings are the roles and responsibilities of people in your church, okay? Good governance is about that kind of clarity that's needed in our roles and responsibilities. Is this a trustee decision or is this an elder's decision? What scope have our team leaders got to make decisions? And what kind of responsibility and authority should we be given? And so we're making those lines really, really clear so that we can travel at the speed that we want to alongside one another in unity. And so getting our roles and responsibilities are super clear. Okay, I'm going to carry on. You're going to start guessing these as we go. Okay, signage. What would signage be? Policy and procedure. Okay. We love it. Church operations people love a good policy. So we need good signage on our motorways, where the exits are, how we need to drive at certain points in the road, that you've got to slow down or you've got to start up. You know, in Wales, we have little signs with sheep on that they're going to run across the road, you know. And so there's an awareness of, okay, what's coming ahead of us that we need to make note of? What are the clear boundaries and how we're going to drive, how we're going to operate? Policy and procedure does that, exactly that. It tells us how we're going to work. It gives us that clarity. And without that kind of clarity, people divert, don't they? They make different decisions. We need that clarity to be able to understand the decisions that we need to make, how we are to operate, what the expectations are. And those things are super, super important. So without signage, without policy, people start guessing, don't they? And that's where it starts to make mistakes. And you get, what happens when you get an accident? You get a slowdown on the motorway. You get a backlog, don't you? Okay, next one. The speed limit, okay? You are going to remember this when you go home. Every time you drive on a motorway, I want you to be thinking about good governance. The speed limit on the motorway is actually a really important factor, isn't it? And those smart motorways that change the speed as you go, a good leader will know the pace at which that church should be travelling. You go too slow, you're in danger, aren't you? We know that. If you go too fast beyond your policy, your procedure, your governing document, you end up getting breakdowns. You end up causing challenges. So that is our speed limit. Okay, last one. I wanted to think about cat's eyes. I wanted to think about floodlights. I couldn't come up with stuff. If you've got some ideas, email me afterwards, right? But every motorway needs maintenance, okay? Isn't that? You can have the best motorway in 3 years' time, okay? You're going to need to do some work on it. You're going to have potholes. You're going to have faded lines. You're going to have signs that are going to be missing. You're going to have a whole array of different things going on. And actually, maintenance is so, so important. And I know so many of you have transferred from a charitable trust to a CIO, and you've done some of the big steps, the central reservations in. You've done some of the work on policy and procedure. But now you get to a point of saying, what does maintenance look like in terms of good governance? And I think this is really important. For some of you, you might have to close off a lane on the motorway for a minute to do some repair work. And actually, maintenance can be seen as failure sometimes. I don't know if you feel that. But actually, it's like the road's actually been used. Do you know what I mean? It's actually been working, and there's a longevity to that, which is quite encouraging, you know? If you're doing maintenance, then that's really encouraging. And the whole point of all of this, how you all fit all this together, is that these things are designed not to be restrictions or boundaries or to, you know, stop you as an elder or a leader leading. These are actually designed to help free flow towards mission, towards moving the church forward. So I'm absolutely convinced that these things will make a huge difference. And for each of us, we're probably at different stages in where we need to invest. And maybe when you're on a motorway on your way home, thinking about, right, what do we need to do? Do we need to work on the central reservation? Do we need some signage? All of these things come together, and they mean that we move together in unity. We move together towards what God has called us to do in our mission and our vision. So that is my link. I'm going to pass over to Becky, who's going to drill down a bit deeper. Love a good motorway. Thank you, Ben.
Okay. You can probably tell by this point that both Gavin and I are really enthusiastic about church governance and operations. I recognise that won't be all of you in this room. A good number of you in this room will probably be sat there thinking, well, that's great, you're really enthusiastic, but this is the last thing I want to be doing. So if you come to me and you say, okay, Becky, I don't know where to start. I'm totally bogged down. There's all this information flying at me. Keep hearing about these different things that we should be doing. I don't know where to start. There's loads of guidance. There's loads of information, but it's totally overwhelming to me. Let's strip it right back and say, what should we be focusing on? If we've got to start somewhere, if we've got to work out, what are our key priorities? I think there are four key areas for us. So here's my four key areas. Let's start with a governing document. Every church should have a governing document. It might be called by different names. Some of you will call it your constitution. Some of it will You will call it your trust deed, your church rules, your handbook, your member's guide, your member's handbook, loads of different names, but all referring to this, a document that sets out why do you exist as a church and how do you operate? If you don't think you have a governing document, that's your first thing that needs some attention. Either to find it, it might be there somewhere and you just don't know where to locate it, or if it really doesn't exist, then getting help in drafting a governing document. So make sure you've got a governing document, but don't just make sure you've got a governing document. Do you know what your governing document says? Do you know what it says about who are your trustees? Do you know what it says about how important decisions need to be made in church life? If you don't know the answer to those questions, that would be the next step on this journey. For some of you, your governing document might have been written a very long time ago. That might mean that it's written in language that feels pretty inaccessible, and you're struggling to pick through what on earth were they on about when they were writing this 75 years ago. If that's you, if it feels completely impenetrable and you're really struggling, then please ask for help. There are lots of people around who can help you pick through what does this actually even say. If that's where you're at, then ask for help with that. Once you've got your governing document and you know what your governing document says, the next question is that how we actually operate in practice? Do we actually do what our governing document says? Or has the governing document kind of been shoved in a filing cabinet and we've wandered out of our lane and we're not quite heading in the right direction? If your governing document doesn't reflect your practice, then of course the question needs to be, do we need to change our governing document to reflect who we are as a church today? Or do we need to change our practice? Or maybe it's a bit of both of those things. I think generally speaking, as a rule of thumb, even if you think your governing document is pretty good, at least every 10 years or so, maybe five if you're a plant who's still quite new, still growing, it's worth sitting down with your governing document and saying, is this the document that reflects who we are as a church today? Does it reflect the needs of the church we are today? It's not impossible to change and update your governing document. There are clearly important steps to go through to do that, but that's well worth considering, a review of your governing document. For some of you, changes are going to be coming in your governance structure in the next few years. So generally speaking, charity whose income is over £5,000 a year need to be registered with the Charity Commission. But for the last couple of decades, FIEC churches have come under something that's called accepted status. That means that if their income's under £100,000 a year, they haven't needed to register with the Charity Commission. But accepted status is coming to an end in 2031. So if you're sat here this afternoon knowing or thinking that possibly you're operating under accepted status, then you do need to start to take some action. We all know that change and getting things done in church life is not a speedy process. So leaving it to the last minute is really not a wise or a sensible option. So you do need to be starting to think about what does it mean for us to think about registering with the Charity Commission. If that's you and you'd value talking that through, then we can make that happen. We can talk those things through. Do ask about that. So that's our governing...
Sorry, is that so broadly with the Charity Commission or specifically as a CIO?
So that question, if you didn't hear it, was, is that broadly with the Charity Commission or is that specifically as a CIO? It is with the Charity Commission. Yeah. Okay, so that's our governing document. That's thing one to be thinking about in our essentials to do well. The second one is policies and procedures. It's probably one of my most frequently asked questions. People who come to me and say, OK, we've got absolutely no policies whatsoever. What are the essentials? If we've got nothing else, if we're starting from scratch, whether that's because we've just haven't thought about this or whether that's because we're a new plant, we're just getting established, we're setting ourselves up. As a minimum, these are the things I think every church needs. So the first one is something about risk management. So policies and procedures around risk management. One of the big responsibilities for trustees is managing risk. And that's not just in that kind of practical health and safety. Is somebody going to trip over? Is somebody going to hurt themselves? That's in the big sense of risk. It's things that are risk to the gospel work that we do. So that's leadership risks, it's reputational risks, it's security and safety risks, it's cybersecurity, it's financial risks. All those things that might be a risk to the work we do as a church. And to some extent, this policy sits over most of what I'm now going to suggest are other policies you should have. What are the things that put at risk the work that we're doing in preaching the gospel? So next one on the list, data protection policy. So thinking about the data we hold, how we hold it, how we use it, how long we keep it for, how do we keep it safe? So that's number two, risk, data protection. Financial management. How do we manage the finances of our church well, whether they be big numbers or actually whether they be really tiny numbers? How do we ensure that the finances, the money that is given to the church, is used for the good of the gospel? How do we do that well? Next one on the list, health and safety policy. How do we keep people safe? Whether that's in our own building or whether that's in a building that we rent or use, for example, in a school or a community centre, we have a responsibility to think about how we keep people safe. Safeguarding policy. You'll see we've been asking about this on annual renewals for FIEC over the last few years. One of the fundamental responsibilities of trustees is protecting those the church comes into contact with, making sure that they're safe, particularly for those who are especially at risk. So children and adults with care and support needs that put them at particular risk of abuse. And then the final one in my kind of essentials list is a bit, this might not quite apply to all of you. If your church has those who serve in a paid capacity, you should also have some good documentation and agreements related to that. That might be because you've got employees, that might be because you've got office holders. Either of those, it's a vitally important area to get right, to make sure that we're caring well for those who are serving the church in that slightly more formal capacity. Of course, there are loads and loads of other areas that we could touch on, policies, other areas to think about, risk assessments, complaint policies, social media policies, food safety policies, managing conflicts of interest. The list could go on and on. And the number of kind of different models that I'm asked for on a regular basis, some make me kind of go, policy on that? Well, I guess we could. So there's an endless list. But really what I'd encourage you to do is start with those basics. Get those basics right. Get those in place. Remember my kind of do what you say and say what you do. So make sure that your policy and your practice match. If your policy says something to what you do in practice, then it's really important to ask the question, actually, is our policy out of date and it needs updating? Or actually, is our practice not great and we need to change our practice to meet our policy? So say what you do and do what you say. Policy should never be documents that you write just because Becky at FIEC says you ought to, then shove in the filing cabinet, never to see the light of day again, or at least only to drag out when something goes wrong. The idea of a policy is to help you think through what's the best way of operating, making sure that you're meeting your legal obligations, your other obligations, and to help everyone be clear about how you operate so that everybody can work together. Is that a hand in the air?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question is, if you didn't hear that, how often should we be reviewing these policies? So the expectation is that safeguarding policies should be reviewed annually. There's also an expectation that your financial management policy should be reviewed annually. The others, there's not that same expectation of an annual review in the guidance, but regular review is really important. Depending on how you operate, probably every 2 to 3 years. I generally encourage people to kind of put them on a cycle. There's nothing worse than sitting in a trustees meeting and realising that you've got 23 policies that all need reviewing simultaneously. That's a surefire way to send everybody to sleep and to put everybody off being a trustee forever. So I'd really encourage you to think about getting in a cycle. It might take you a while to get there, but so that you do a few policies at a time rather than a really painful, let's do everything at once. Okay, so the question, if you didn't hear that, is where we've got big, extensive documents, an example of that might be your staff handbook. How do we make sure that they're relevant, they're appropriate? How do we help our trustees by not just sending them a 67-page document and saying, review it? Is that a fair summary of the question? I think my first question to you would be, staff handbooks are absolutely vital. Don't get me wrong on that. Whether it is helpful to have it all in one document, I'd ask that question. You might find it more helpful to chop that into chunks to make it more accessible. I think for an individual or a small group of people to work through documents and take particular responsibilities for different areas can be helpful. We'll talk a little bit more later about resources that are out there, but there are model policies in lots of these areas available from ourselves at FIEC, from the Church Office, from Ed Connor's solicitors. Use those models. They will be based on good practice. They'll give you good pointers in terms of what is relevant, appropriate, up-to-date, meets your requirements. So do look to use those. Lots of these model documents, when they are revised, there'll be information that says, this is what we've changed in this area, so that you're not trying to scan through and work out, oh, this looks slightly different, but I can't quite work out how. And ask for help and support. Okay, let's keep moving. So the next one is communication and engagement. I think this is really important for good governance. Now, this will look really different depending on your church, depending on the size of your church, depending on the makeup of your church, depending on your ecclesiology. But fundamentally, I think it's important for everybody. So who makes up your church family? The leaders, the members, the wider congregation, members of the community who come along and attend activities you put on. And when you think about those different groups, who needs to know what information? What's the best way of communicating with that particular group? How do we engage our church family well so that everybody's on board with what we're working to do? Perhaps thinking back to your governing document, who needs to be consulted about what decisions in church life? That'll look very different for different churches. And it will look different for different churches at different stages in their church life. When you're tiny, it looks very different to if you've got several hundred members. Those things will look different, so you'll need to work that through for yourself. But I think fundamentally, making sure that communication and engagement is good at all those different levels is really important. And then lastly, structures. Clear structures are really helpful. Gavin's already talked about this in a motorway illustration. Being clear about who's responsible for what, having good mechanisms in place for accountability. Again, different churches will operate differently, but things like having a rolling cycle of regular meetings with regular business can really help. So, you know, that might mean saying, OK, so we have four trustees meetings a year. It's always on the first week of October, December, February and June. And then allocating different regular business to different ones of those. So it might be that you review your financial management policy in your October meeting. You look at your safeguarding policy and procedures in December. February, you might particularly focus on your budget. All those sorts of kind of regular cycles of things, I think, can be really helpful. Partly because it makes sure that things that need to happen, happen. But I think it also takes a little bit less brain space. If you take a little bit of time to sit down, work out a regular cycle, and then each time you come to the next trustees meeting, you kind of go, OK, it's October, so we do this and this. What else do we need to think about? Just helps free up a little bit of brain space. At least it does for me. For some churches, delegating some tasks to a small subgroup can be really helpful. I recognise for some churches, that's an amazing idea. But frankly, it's not going to happen because there are very, very few of you. But for those of you for whom that might be a possibility, that can be helpful. Check what your governing documents say. But very often there's provision there to engage people who are not trustees to support the work of the trustees. So it might be that there's somebody in your congregation who'd be willing to come alongside the treasurer and help with some of the day-to-day things. That it may not be appropriate for them to be a trustee, but they may be able to support in that way. Similarly, with things like maintaining a building, if you have a building, you might have somebody on your trustee group who's particularly responsible for that area. But are there a couple of other people in the church, not part of the trustee group, but have perhaps got a little bit of time, who'd be willing to help and engage with small building tasks, checks that need doing, or help on an ad hoc basis with that sort of thing, to support and help the trustees in that way. So that's our kind of four areas of governance. If you're going to start somewhere, if you want to know where to start to get the essentials underway, that's what I suggest you. Gavin's going to talk a little bit now about the benefits of some of doing this well. Hello. So the question for anybody who didn't hear that was, when you fill in your charity commission annual return, for those of you who do that, not all of you will do that because of your size, but if you do that, you're asked a series of questions about, do you have this policy? Yes, no, not applicable. When you answer those questions, you can say no, and there isn't a consequence to that. The question is about whether that will change. I think it's possible. We're not there yet. That's definitely one to watch. If we become aware of that coming down the road, we will absolutely make you aware of that.
Thank you very much.
Can I give you a microphone, Rosie? Just then everybody can hear you.
So I'm a charity solicitor at Edward Connor Solicitors. I would say that there may not be a consequence with the Charity Commission, but there could be a consequence if someone made a complaint against your charity to the Commission. So the first thing they would do would be to open investigation and then write to the trustees and ask them. So, for example, if there was a complaint about safeguarding or what you've put on your internet, a sermon that's been preached that someone's complained about, then the Charity Commission will write to the trustees and say, have you got, and they will select the relevant policies. So in some ways you can say no and there isn't a direct consequence, but when something goes wrong or someone makes a complaint, then you will be asked to put those policies in place.
Okay, so the original question, if I understand it correctly, was would there be a clash between the law and charity law? I think you've clarified that slightly to say what are the possibilities of the law clashing with our Christian principles?
Because I think that's where we will come into difficulties as Christians.
We need to be prepared for it. Yeah.
I think we do. I think we mustn't be naive, and I think we must be, you know, we must be responsible for the laws of the land, but we also try to uphold what we believe are principles, biblical principles, and I think we're going to face more and more clashes, and we'll probably all have a different opinion of that in this room and throughout church, throughout Britain. But I think we need to know where the law either protects us or doesn't protect us.
So currently, I think the law is, Romans 13, we're called to obey our authorities, aren't we? And most of those laws, loads of those policies that the Charity Commission ask us to tick are things that would do the church a lot of good. Mm. To have really clear financial management policies. Absolutely. And this is probably what you're about to talk about, isn't it? The benefits of getting this right currently. But of course, as we've always got to be mindful of the fact that society is going in a different direction. But at the moment, we would encourage compliance in all areas because
it's a way of loving.
I'll take one more question. I think just to perhaps round that out, I think as these things change, at FIEC, at Edward Connor, we'll keep you up to date. We'll keep putting helpful information out. We'll be happy to engage with churches. That's what we're here to do. So I think as these things come down the line, we're not just going to leave you to it in that regard. Another question?
Yeah.
I'll give you a microphone.
I don't really need a microphone in my voice, but yeah.
We're going on record. This seminar is being recorded.
Oh, okay.
So if you've not managed to scribble notes, then you will be able to listen back, and some people aren't able to be here, so it's good for them to hear the questions.
Well, I was going to say, I might be wrong. I'm not sure what our brother thought just there, but I think his question may have been precipitated by the fact that whilst I think most in this room would be in agreement that we want to be compliant with charities, law as churches, I think the example that our sister here, sorry, I don't know your name, used was if we got a complaint from a sermon. And I think that's what a lot of us are worried about, because as much as we want to be compliant with the Charities Commission, we know, and I think this is what our brother was saying, that when we preach the Word of God faithfully, there's going to be things that, legally speaking, may bump up against the laws of the land. And I think it was that really which was what was precipitated the question.
No, thank you. That's helpful. These are things that we are going to have to continue to reflect on together as things change and as things develop. Something definitely to be prayerful about in the coming while. Thanks, Gavin.
These are good questions, aren't they? They are helpful. There are tensions in this. My interactions with the Charities Commission has been very positive. And they are there to support us and to work through this. So I think going back to the main point about some of the policy and procedure that we need in the reporting, just be as honest as you can of what you are doing. And our policy procedure should reflect what we're trying to do from our vision and our mission, and it's got to flow from that. So the way that we are working is described in our policy, and then, we trust God that is. So... with confidence that we're doing what we're doing well as we can. These are good questions, and we're not going to be able to cover everything. Just a couple of thoughts on what Becky said. One point to take away really is the maintenance plan actually is a really, really helpful suggestion. And as leaders and elders, when, if you're reviewing your policy in September, That's the worst time. That's our busiest season, isn't it? And so actually, what are the different aspects of maintenance that you need? Put it down into a plan. And and do it as part of a team. Don't feel the responsibility to do this on your own is one thing to ensure. Do this as a team. Draw other people in. Put together that plan and then follow that plan and review that plan. And everything feels a lot more straightforward when you've got that. I don't know if that's... There's some people nodding. When you have that plan in place, you know, so we go away on a pastoral team retreat in January. It's kind of our first start of the year. There are decisions that are made there that affect the budget, that affect all the different things, that if we don't have a trustees meeting fairly soon on, like the end of January, I need a trustees meeting because I need to get some of this stuff approved. If I'm waiting till February or March, I'm losing time and I'm losing the interest as well from some of our leaders. So actually having that detailed plan will make a huge difference. We haven't had any stories yet, so let me tell you two stories about governance. One poor and one good, okay? And hopefully to inspire us as well. I came across a church who had fantastic vision, just really clarity of where God was calling them to work in the city. They had organised a bunch of new roles. They had worked it out in the budget, and they were going to sell one of their buildings to finance this new vision going forward. And it was fantastic, and it was building momentum. It went out to all the members. At the point of sale of that building, they hadn't realised that they hadn't updated the trustees' details with the land registry. Okay, I think three of them had passed away. And one or two of them were in a care home in their 90s. And now relationally and with the solicitors and everything, we're having to work through that now. So if there isn't a better example of how poor governance affects your mission, it was this church. It was like the motorway just came to a standstill. They'd lost momentum. And as a leadership, they felt like absolute failures. And these are the kind of things that really impact us as we do our mission and vision. So actually, really good governance makes a difference for the gospel. And if you can leave with that in mind, what a difference that will make in your church. Let me give you a positive one then, okay? Church not far from me, next to a nightclub, of all places, in the city centre. Nightclub had a fire, burnt the whole building down completely, church building down. It's taken them 6 years to rebuild it and to work through it. I was speaking to the leader the other day, and he said to me there was one or two trustees who did an outstanding job of ongoing maintenance that made all the difference to that whole experience in leading that church through that situation. She had faithfully updated the insurance policy every year, taking into account the contents, thinking about the rebuild costs, how those rebuild costs had changed from 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. She was a trustee for 15 years, did a fantastic job. And in the middle of it, the insurance company chose a builder, and the builder went into liquidation halfway through the work. I never seen anything like it. And this church leader said to me, I would never have made it through if it wasn't for this lady who just faithfully got on in the background with the maintenance. I was inspired by that, because I know for many of you, you are doing some of this background work that nobody sees, that's unimpressive, but it really does connect to the gospel. And that church were able to rebuild, you know, four or five lanes of the motorway. Their gospel effectiveness in that city is significant. They got a full payout of something like 6.1 million. And they've just been able to, you know, and you pull the thread on that and say, what worked well? Oh, that lady who just faithfully got on the phone to the insurance company and did the risk assessments, did the 5-year electrical tests, did the fire stuff, did all the testing, made all the records possible. That's the grace of God. So I pray that you would be that grace to your leaders and serving them. So two stories to finish. Becky.
Okay, so in a minute, we're going to open up for more questions. I suspect that a good number of you have got some questions. But just before we do that, we're going to think about resources that might help us. We've talked about why good governance is important. We've talked about the basics of good governance. We've talked about the benefits of good governance. But what helps out there? What support is available for you? I guess maybe we'll get the bad news out the way first. There is no one out there who can do all this for you. I'm sorry, there is no one who can come in and do all of this for you. But the good news is that there are loads of resources available to help and support you. You have got this information on the handouts on your seat. If you haven't got a handout, there are a few more at the front, and it will go out after the conference as a digital copy for those of you for whom that's helpful. So firstly, training. If you're feeling pretty unsure, lost in terms of governance, then I'd really encourage you to think about accessing some training. In the world of Zoom, Microsoft Teams, accessing training has never been more straightforward. No trekking up and down the country for inconveniently timed training. We'll hear a little bit from Edward Connor Solicitors in a minute, but they offer training for trustees. ACAT, the Association of Church Accountants and Treasurers, also offer trustee training. This training's all online. Some of it is on demand. Most of it is designed so that it runs at times that are accessible for volunteers. You know, so it happens in lunch hours. It happens in the evenings. It happens at weekends. So do look out for that sort of training. The Charity Commission themselves do offer training for those involved in governance in faith-based charities. It's longer, it's a bigger commitment, but well worthwhile if you've got capacity to engage with that. Again, we'll hear a bit more from Gavin in a moment about the church office, but they're just launching a new on-demand course looking at church management. Another great opportunity there for training. That's training opportunities. If there's something specific that you're looking for training on, then do ask about that. We've got lots of contacts. We've got lots of people who would love to talk to you about different training options. So do ask about that. Secondly, if you need help getting governing documents, policies, procedures in place, model documents can be a really helpful place to start. A kind of framework to guide you through the things you need to cover. At FIEC, we offer model policies. They're available on our website. Same is true of the church office. Lots of model policies available. For some of the more specialist areas that we've talked about, Edward Connor Solicitors, who we partner with, have got some great packs of model documents to help you through areas like employment, office holding, those sorts of things, to do make the most of those model documents. Sitting alongside that training, those model documents, I guess lots of you might find at different points in church life some more personalised help and advice would be helpful. At FIEC, we offer our advice line either by phone or by email. You'll generally come through to me if you call or email. That's an opportunity to ask questions, ask for support. If you find that helpful at any point, please, please do get in touch. These cards are around through the conference. They've got phone number, email address on. Do pick up one of those. Take it away in case it's helpful for you. No question is too silly. No question is too small. You would be, maybe you wouldn't be, astounded by the range of questions that I've been asked. There are very, very few areas that I think would totally surprise me. I've been asked about everything from emotional support animals in church and whether that's okay, through to much more complex questions about policies. So do ask, please, if you need help. I'm also able to come out and visit you, arrange Zoom calls with your leadership team if that's helpful, turn up to meetings, done all those sorts of things. where the help is more specialist that's required. We've got really good links. I've mentioned Edward Connor Solicitors several times. So Edward Connor Solicitors offer legal advice, 30 minutes free legal advice for FIEC churches. I can put you in contact with them if that's the help you need. So do ask about that as well. I also send out regular email updates about things that churches need to be aware of. That goes out to all the what we call primary correspondents, so the main person at each church that we correspond with. But anybody can sign up for those. If the person who gets those emails is not necessarily the person they need to go to, then do go on our website and follow through the newsletters. Sign up for the fully operational email, and you'll get those about every 6 weeks they come out with things you need to know about. Okay, I've mentioned them enough times now. Gemma, is it you or is it Rosie? I've asked Gemma just to come and give us kind of a two-minute overview. What can Edward Connor offer to help and support churches?
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Gemma. Edward Joshua Paul Connor, who set up FIC back in 1922, he set up an association of mutual helpfulness. He recognised then the need for independent churches to have access to resources like this and to be able to find somewhere they could speak to about legal issues. How much more so now, we're so much heavily regulated, it is a huge burden on churches. We have trial by social media if you get things wrong. That it's wonderful that FIC and church office are there for you to speak to about those operational issues. When it gets to the level where you need technical expertise, that's why FIC set up Edward Connor Solicitors, because we can provide that specialist legal advice. We're all lawyers, all experienced in the areas of law that churches need help with. We only act for churches and Christian organisations. We're uniquely a Christian charity as well as a fully regulated law firm. So that is our area of expertise. And all of our lawyers are Christians as well, often. But many of them are in leadership positions doing roles like yours. We offer a range of things that Becky's talked about already and Gavin, that help with your governance and getting your constitutions, your CIOs or however you choose to do that, the property work. We talked about Charity Commission complaints. We have helped churches that have received Charity Commission complaints and dealing with the Charity Commission in those times. We have... We didn't use a motorway. We used a much more beautiful illustration of it. One of the our strapline actually is to help your ministry to flourish. And I know it feels like a distraction dealing with these things, and it's a burden. But actually, churches that do this well it's good for the gospel. It's good to shine the stars in this area. And so we try to put together a little booklet to say, what would that look like to be flourishing in this area? So there's some, we'll give you one of these when you go out. If you would like to come and do a quiz, many of you have said, we just want to know if we're getting this right. Are we roughly on the right lines? You can come and do a quiz with us today, and we're just by the bookstall. And just a few questions and might give you some things to go away and think about. You'll see, you can't miss our bright lime green T-shirt. So if this is your chance at the conference to get free legal advice, if you do have a question and just want to talk something through, or do I need to get legal advice on this or not, then do come and take that opportunity. We've got a range of experience here for that reason. Thanks.
All right, you might have had a leaflet thrusted in at you at some point in the conference. Becky's already mentioned it. We've got a good church management course that we've put together. It's taken me 2 years, and by the grace of God, it's finally here. Looking at kind of all operations and administration behind the scenes in churches. So how do we move what God has called us to in our vision and our mission into action? Looking at a whole various different modules. It's been written for leaders, and really for leaders to get an idea of the work that needs doing behind the scenes, not that we expect them to do that, but being able to delegate more effectively, knowing these different areas will help you. So it's available for you to purchase online. You can work through it at your own pace. There's a coaching session with it, and there's some various other bits and bobs. The best resources that we've got, we're kind of really putting into this. So I don't have anything else other than that. Okay, that is all I've got. I've pumped everything into that. The other thing that we do, which is quite popular, is something called a back office review. I can see some church leaders here who have had one of these. You should, you know, tell them about it. It went terribly wrong. No, it didn't go terribly wrong, did it? But it's an opportunity to have an outside view of how things are going behind the scenes for your church. So we'll look at your operational plan, your staffing structures, your policy and procedure. We'll look at how you're navigating things behind the scenes. And it's an opportunity for someone to come on site and really give you that kind of Jethro perspective. In Exodus 18, it says, hang on, what are you doing really well? What are some of the areas you need to change in and grow in? And we can help you, you know, come alongside you in that and support you. So those are key things. The website's got a whole bunch of stuff. You can check it out. You know, our heart is to not just to make you more efficient, but actually to make your gospel effective. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm bothered about admin and ops, because the gospel is the most important thing to me. There's some notes here. If you love the motorway illustration, then I've written it down for you. You can take it home. And this is like a section of our Good Church Management course in a little bit more detail than the time we've had. So please, if you'd like one, please help yourself. I think that covers everything.
Great. Thanks very much. That's all the content that we're going to do, I guess, to you. What we're going to do now is we're going to open up the floor for questions. If I can ask as much as you can to try and keep your questions sufficiently general that it's kind of relevant and appropriate for a good proportion of people in the room, that would be really helpful. If you've got a really specific question that's perhaps a little bit niche to your situation or your church, then please do remember that upstairs, outside the main meeting area, we've got all of our kind of practical support areas. So I'm around up there, Gavin and the church office are there, Edward Connor solicitors are there, ACAT are there, Christian Safeguarding Services are there. So if you've got a question that's kind of a little bit niche for you, or you just need a little bit longer to dig into something, then please do make the most of the rest of today and tomorrow when you've got people face to face to ask those questions. We'd love to help and support you in that way. The other just very practical thing to say is I am going to pass the microphone round so that we can hear your question, so that those on the recording can hear your question. I know it might be a little bit clunky, but that is quite important. So if you can wait until you've got the microphone in your hand, and then if you can pass the microphone back so we can make sure that the answers come back through the microphone too, that would be really helpful. Okay, let's go.
You spoke about the transfer from charitable trust to CIO. What's that?
I think this might be one for Rosie. Different forms of charitable structure and the possibility of transferring from a trust, an unincorporated, to a CIO. In 2 minutes, Rosie. Go.
Well, a trust is an unincorporated organisation where the trustees are legally liable for the actions that they make, whereas a CIO is an incorporated organisation. It's not a company. It was introduced in 2013 as a way that charities can have limited liability. So there is a process. It's the Charity Commission call it a merger, where you create this new charity. It's a legal entity and it can hold property in its name. So the CIO, like a company, would hold property and it would employ employees. So it relieves trustees of their personal liability for the acts of the charity. So that's the main benefit. And there's a process that you go through setting up the new charity and then transferring all your assets, employees, across to it. And that's something we do day in, day out. It's quite a regular thing that we do. But we do need to, you need to review your documents to make sure that they're compatible. It's, you know, there are various things and steps that you would need legal guidance to make sure that that's a process that you can follow. So we wouldn't advise you to do it all on your own. You might make some steps and then come to us for for help, or we can do all of that for you.
Okay, so that's a 2-minute summary. If you want more detailed information on what that might look like for your church, then do talk to ECS about that. Gemma, you were about to say something. Okay, there is a booklet upstairs on the Edward Connor stall that would give you a little bit of light reading material before you start the conversation.
Thank you. Follow-on question from our brother's question there. On the transfer that's happening for many churches to become CIOs, it costs a lot of money, doesn't it, for quite a few? I've heard some £12,000 in total, and you probably know of other figures that people... any advice on how smaller churches with limited budgets can manage that cost of the actual transfer?
I was just going to say, Becky and Gavin both did such a brilliant job. And just on cost, I think you can chunk it down into stages. You know, obviously you can set up the CIO, do the transfer. One of the most expensive things on a transfer is that when you are transferring an unregistered property, if it's not been registered with the land registry because it hasn't changed hands before, that then the transfer into the CIO is a compulsory registration. So you have to register it. And then obviously if you've got very ancient deeds or you've got trustees, someone mentioned trustees that were incapable or had died, those are the sorts of things that make the costs go up. So reviewing your deeds and making sure you've got the right trustees in place and those documents. So you could chunk it into sort of different categories. I'm not sure how you keep the cost, legal costs down. It's we've been talking about maintenance, haven't we? And I think if you haven't maintained it for 50 years and you haven't looked at your deeds, then you've got more than potholes, you know, and that's the issue. Costs will increase the longer you leave things. And then I think that's one of the things that we can encourage you to do is just keep reviewing. Because in some ways, lots of little costs as you go along is better than doing a massive repair job. So I don't know where you find funds, but I would say you can chunk it down into, you know, sort your property out, then do the transfer. That's one way. But you can't not sort out property as part of the transfer. And that usually is the most expensive thing, where you'd get to £12,000. I don't think if you had a registered property and you had employees, we would be anywhere near that. If all your documents are up to date, I don't think it would cost that much.
It's a similar question, actually, but not so much about money, but more about pastors' resource. So where we've got large churches, often you'll have an operations director, you'll have teams of deacons, to do that. And you rightly mentioned how this can be quite resource intensive. Getting it right is important, but it can be resource intensive. I guess one of my questions particularly was for you, in your role, what is your experience? Is this something that pastors normally spend their time doing? I've seen a few pastors basically not be able to do the work of a pastor because they're trying to keep on top of this. And how would you speak into that kind of tension?
I mean, it's a massive tension, isn't it? And it will look very different in different churches. I would love to tell you that the ideal is that this is not the work of a pastor. You know, I would love to be able to say this is an area in which I would love to see every church resourced with somebody else who could come alongside. Not that the pastor is disengaged. That would be almost as bad, I think, if the pastor was completely disengaged from the process. But I recognise that that's a massive challenge in our churches. Some churches are simply very people resource poor. And so the reality is that in a good number of churches, pastors will be more heavily involved than would be the ideal. I'd massively encourage you to look across your congregation and see if there are those who can help and support. As we've mentioned, you know, at FIEC we can offer support. Edward Connor can offer support. So there are external supports. But yeah, I recognise it's a massive challenge. And it's often why this process takes a while. I mentioned that for those of you who are operating under accepted status, 5-year horizon for accepted status coming to an end, that'll come very fast because it does just take time because of that capacity issue.
It's a really good question. And what I've found working, you know, with churches outside of the FIC as well, and you know, cut this off if you need to, Adrian, or whoever is editing this. But I found that some churches have got a couple or one non-elder trustee, and that's made a big difference. So we've recruited someone for maybe a period of time to be a non-elder trustee who actually has some real skills in governance and finances and policy and procedure. And it may just be for a season that they're on, but I have certainly seen non-elder trustees really functioning well with those other elders as trustees, which made a difference. So it is thinking a little bit outside the box, and just on a very small practical level, I have gone to a couple of churches who will combine their trustees and their elders meetings together and will minute all of those, and somebody is putting the work in to do all of that. Yet their governing document says they need to meet 4 times a year. And so all of that is good practice, but we can look at that and think about our capacity again and go, actually, is there a way that actually we should have separate trustees meetings to our elders meetings and not spend the huge amounts of time minuting everything in an elders meeting? You know, where are the small margins that can help us do this better is my advice.
Thanks, Kev. Other question?
Rather than a question, can I just give a little bit of a plug, if I may?
It depends what you're plugging.
So I'm Graham from the Slade in Plumstead. This time last year, I was here, bumped into Gav at the church office stand, was charmed by his snake oil salesman pitch, but he came along to do. So at the Slade, we, if you think like Ray Evans, Ready, Steady, Grey, we're very much that awkward sized church, you know, and we were. In the goodness of the Lord, folks were coming in, and we were looking to make sure we had the right structures in place for that growth. And bumped into Gav, and we were talking about back office review and stuff. So came to us in the new year. I know for some folks, the online resources, free resources, is all they need. For us, we wanted something a little bit more hands-on. I cannot recommend enough the work that Gavin and the team did with the review. The report that we got back, it was insightful, helpful. We've now appointed a operations lead as well. So, you know, we haven't looked back from that. So I just wanted to say, if you're in that position that you need that extra support, I would thoroughly recommend that.
Wonderful. Thank you. There was another question. I saw a hand somewhere.
I wondered if you could just speak into, like, how you bring the church membership along with some of this stuff, because it might be that sort of the elders and the staff team buy into it, but actually if there's been a church plant that's grown in membership, it might seem to them that some of these more formal processes and policies can mean that we're not really a church family anymore, it's become quite formal. So how can we help church members to see that this is for the good of the gospel?
Very good question, isn't it? And there is a transition point, isn't there, from being a church plant or an early church, which is quite organic and quite fluid, and we haven't needed as much structure. So I think we do have to envision the church, don't we, that actually as we want to grow, we don't want to just manage where the church is at currently with its structures and processes. We want to actually build for the future. And so much of it is actually convincing leaders that this is so important. And that's the challenge for me. The fact that you're here, this room is full, is so encouraging. And there's so many elders in the room is so encouraging, because if you guys see this through the gospel lens, you will share that, you will pass that on to your church. You will be a culture carrier, if you like, of gospel ministry in this, which helps the church to bring them along. And I think, you know, church meetings are great points, aren't they, to envision people. And we can often think, maybe, oh, we'll do one this year or we'll do two. But actually, if you're in a season where you need to envision the church more, why not do some more? And look harder, is there anyone in our church who has the gifts to put themselves forward to help in some of this as well? And the committee ideas of drawing in some committees to work on different aspects is great. So I think I would just want to keep building momentum. This work, the delivery part of our our church ministry work is about people, isn't it? Working with people. So how do we have conversations about it? How do we envision our church to see this as not restrictive, but actually growing? So that would be my, Vic, that's my best answer. Yeah.
Okay, we've probably got time for one last question in that back corner, and then we'll be out of time so that you can get a cup of tea before the very exciting AGM.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to ask a question about the anti-terrorism type rules. We're in a church where we're in a very rural area. It's less likely to be a problem, but we know we need to accommodate them. Our other issue is the buildings, the way we get around the fire safety is by unlocking the doors so that people can get out. So we haven't got push doors and that sort of thing. How would you advise us? And is there a one that takes precedent over another just at this stage? Or do we have to shut the building because we can't meet both requirements?
I'm really grateful to the Evangelical Alliance, who've done a lot of work on Martin's Law, and some of that, you know, it's nicknamed that in a sense. The church office has done a podcast with an interview of them of what are the implications for a church. And I think at the minute where we're going to fall is if you're 200 and under, that there's exemptions in that, so there are no limitations for that. If you go over the 200, then there's some expectations on training and on risk assessments and things like that. If you get into the 700s, then it's a different ball game. But as far as I know, it hasn't been confirmed yet. But most churches will be classified at 200 or under. So there's kind of nothing really to fear at the minute, I think. And I think there's the INVAC procedure that's needed and the XVAC procedure. I think if you're up to date on your fire procedures and you've done that quite regularly, then you've almost got a bit of confidence that we can do that. The INVAC, I think, is going to need a little bit more thought. And the government were offering some free training early on when it came out. So again, keep an eye on the church office and Becky. I think we want to try and signpost people to experts in this. But at the minute, there's nothing to do. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think just to kind of add a couple of things to that, it is really once you get to that 800 plus, which will be a very limited number of our churches, where physical measures are needed in your building. Before that, the majority of it is training, is risk assessments, thinking about some of these kind of processes. The other thing to say is, I'm sure the lawyers would frown at me for saying this, but there's a slight oddity in the way that the law works, in that the law has passed, but there is now a 2-year implementation period. So there's 2 years before you will be absolutely required to do some of these things. We have been promised during that, at some point during that implementation period, that there will be practical guidance. That guidance has not yet been published. So I think lots of people are starting to feel a bit like, oh, we should be doing something. We're holding back slightly, at least at FIEC, on putting lots of information out until we've seen that guidance, so that we can be really clear with you what is required. So I think I'd say don't stress too much about it now. Keep watching for the emails that come out. As soon as we have more information, we'll make sure that comes out to you, and we'll make sure that comes out to you with guidance, with model documents, to help you work through all of this stuff.
Really sorry, Becky. 30 seconds on what on earth you're talking about.
So, following the terrorist attacks in Manchester at the Ariana Grande concert, new legislation has been brought in, which... Martin's Law, yes, otherwise known, that's its nickname. I think it's protection of premises, something along those lines. And basically, it's designed to put in measures in public buildings to protect people in the event of terrorist attacks. Okay, thank you very much for coming, everybody. I'm really aware it's been quite warm in here, so thank you for bearing with us. Go get some fresh air, go get a cup of coffee. AGM, your most exciting part of this conference, upstairs at 4:30.